on this episode of Rebel Spirit Radio.
Yeah. Revolutionary optimism is a self-generated a way of living as a love-centered activist. And I find that a lot of people don't think that they're doing enough. And I'm wanting to clarify that in my view, self-care, taking care of oneself, all the parts of ourselves, are love-centered actions.
Yeah.
Family, loved ones, community, and our jobs even. Many people's jobs are directly related to, you know, being like your job is related to getting, you know, healing messages out there and, you know, creating better pathways for people to live on. So all that counts. And there's a period of time that I'm calling for peaceful revolutions. We don't have to do that forever, but there is a period of time where that is necessary in order to transform from the direction that we're going on now. So that is an invitation. And not everyone has to go on the streets. That's the good news, you know. Only 3.5%, according to the people that have studied movements, have found that as a minimum, but you need like widespread public support and non-cooperation with the old broken systems in order to have a successful, peaceful revolution. So we know how to do it. It's just, are we ready?
Welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio, exploring the frontiers of spirituality, consciousness, the esoteric, and humanity's sacred relationship with a living earth. I'm your host, Nick Mather, and in this episode, I am joined by physician, author, and global justice and human rights activist, Paul Zeitz, to discuss his book, Revolutionary Optimism, 7 Steps for Living as a Love-Centered Activist. Paul and I discuss overcoming pessimism, the importance of self-care, unity consciousness, and the necessity of unlocking our radical imagination to co-create a new world. Also, please be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. Your support is truly appreciated. Dr. Paul Zeitz is a preventative medicine physician, epidemiologist, author, and award-winning champion of global justice and human rights. Drawing from over 35 years of advocacy, campaigning, and political movement leadership, Zeitz is the initiator of Hashtag Unify Movements, a movement-building platform dedicated to catalyzing new, love-centered social, economic, and political systems committed to our collective repair, justice, and peace. As a new movement, Hashtag Unify USA was launched in 2023 as a peaceful revolutionary political movement to co-create a United States 2.0 through urgent constitutional renewal. Zeitz has a breadth of experience spanning diverse sectors, including climate transformation, racial and gender equity, authentic democracy, sustainable development, child welfare, and global health in the U.S. and globally. Currently, he serves as a co-convener of the U.S. National Truth, Racial Healing, and Transformation Movement, on the steering committee of the March for Equity, and on the board of directors of ALEF, Alliance for Jewish Renewal. Zeitz proudly serves on the Survivors Council of the HEAT Initiative, which is dedicated to eradicating childhood sexual violence. His debut memoir, published in 2018, Waging Justice, A Doctor's Journey to Speak Truth and Be Bold, offers profound personal perspectives on how one's deep individual healing is intricately connected with the repair of our broken world. Zeitz was ordained as a Sher HaSharim rabbi in 2023. He has been certified by the American Board of Preventative Medicine since 1993, and he joins me today to discuss his latest book, Revolutionary Optimism, 7 Steps for Living as a Love-Centered Activist. Paul, welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio.
Thank you so much, Nick. It's an honor to be here, and I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Well, it's an honor to speak with you. You've accomplished quite a bit. It's very, very impressive. And I left out a huge chunk in that biography just for timing. And I think that your work is perfect for this podcast. It is the epitome of a rebel spirit, right? So I thought that...
Thank you. I take that as a big compliment. I was so excited to come on because I was like, yeah, I'm definitely a rebel spirit, so...
Yeah,
I was excited to, you know, be with you.
Yeah, one of my role models is Henry David Thoreau, and many things that he wrote, but from Civil Disobedience, where he says, "Let your life be a counter friction to the machine." So that's always in the background of what I hope to do. But I thought that I would begin with this question, because the title of the book is Revolutionary Optimism. And it seems right now that it's very difficult to be optimistic, that there are so many things that we are facing. I'm not going to go through the litany of them, that sometimes it seems overwhelming and maybe even a little bit hopeless. And I was wondering, how can we counter that?
Yeah, thanks, Nick. I have those feelings. I have a feeling at times of being overwhelmed and anxious and panicky, fear-based responses to the situation that we're in, the wars, the collapsing of our democracy. The climate emergency is particularly upsetting to me. I'm a scientist, so I know what's going on. And then I see the inaction by humanity, and it's very disturbing. And I get sad and I feel grief and shame about, it's so overwhelming, all the suffering that we're experiencing now and what is coming forward. And then I am in touch with my anger. I feel betrayed by my government. I feel betrayed by, a system that is not allowing me to feel comfortable that knowing that my children, my grandchildren, your children, everyone's children and grandchildren are going to have a viable, inhabitable planet, let alone peaceful, loving society. I just don't think we're heading in that direction, and we could. So I'm a physician by training, and I had to experiment over all those years that you described to come up with practices, and I call them RXs or prescriptions that I use. And I decided to put them together and share them with a vision for this moment that we're in right now. Humanity is really at a crossroads, in my view. We are on a path of destruction. We have violent revolutions underway. We are acting like a herd of buffalo flying off the cliff into our almost probable certain extinction, and not that long away. And we have the solutions. We actually can fix it. We have the ingenuity, the diversity, the beauty of humanity, and we need a new relationship with ourselves, with each other, and with the planet so that we can live in a new way so that we could actually succeed in solving all these complex, what I call super crises.
And they're all interconnected. There's,
Exactly. Yeah.
it's a the phrase that I learned when I was in my doctoral program was it's a wicked problem.
Well, what you said, though, that awareness that you just spoke of, they're all interconnected, that is a huge leap forward, because one of the challenges that we're facing is that a lot of people are siloed in their different issue area, their different priority, their little, people get siloed for many reasons. And part of what I think is needed is for people to stay in your silo. We honor and respect you. Keep doing whatever you do. And have a view of the inner, what you said, that it's all interrelated. And how can we unify? How can we join forces and, co-create this shared vision that I think many of us have?
And it seems to me that one of the important aspects here is that I think often people, when they get this feeling of overwhelm, and they don't know where to turn, sometimes there's this idea of that no one's doing anything, but people are doing things. There is a vast network of activist organizations going on. So where do you think a
Well, can I
person
pause on
should
that? I
start?
want to just clarify. So, revolutionary optimism is a self-generated a way of living as a love-centered activist. And I find that a lot of people don't think that they're doing enough. And I'm wanting to clarify that, in my view, self-care, taking care of oneself, all the parts of ourselves are love-centered actions. Family, loved ones, community, and our jobs even. Many people's jobs are directly related to, being like your job is related to getting healing messages out there and, creating better pathways for people to live on. So all that counts. And there's a period of time that I'm calling for peaceful revolutions. We don't have to do that forever, but there is a period of time where that is necessary in order to transform from the direction that we're going on now. So that is an invitation. And not everyone has to go on the streets. That's the good news. Only 3.5%, according to the people that have studied movements, have found that as a minimum, but you need like widespread public support and non-cooperation with the old broken systems in order to have a successful peaceful revolution. So we know how to do it. It's just, are we ready? And it's a big we. I will see. I'm ready. I don't know. I know a lot of people are ready. People are talking about this on the street, so.
Yeah, for sure. So the place to begin then is with yourself and your family and communities.
Number one priority is self-care. And I look at that as from my physical body, how I am physically, how I am emotionally. Am I living an open-hearted life? Am I in open-hearted relationships with loved ones? Am I triggered, or am I like, angry all the time with people I love? I have to work on myself. I have to always be taking care of my emotional being because I want to be a loving presence. And I've had that intent for many decades, but I haven't always been that. And I apologize to anyone who knows me when I wasn't living my full loving self. And then intellectually, am I living, am I stimulated? Am I learning? Am I curious? Am I open to new perspectives? And spiritually, am I connected to what I call, the great mystery or the love force or whatever you want to call it? I have an interspiritual kind of view. Many paths, everyone finds their own way, but there is something greater than ourselves. We know that. So
Right.
connecting,
Yeah. And
or
that's what,
I believe that.
yeah. And in the book, you refer to this as the unified consciousness, I believe, right?
I do, and that is, I believe that it's important for the readers of the book and listeners to understand that we can access unified consciousness or unity consciousness or Jesus consciousness, whatever you want to call, Muhammad consciousness, whoever your God is or whatever you call that, there's that connection where you have a state of mind where you're in connection with that. First of all, not everyone knows that you can do that or have that experience. Then once you have it, you get a taste of it. And then with practice, and there are practices in the book and other, like going to the gym, you learn how to deploy it, when you need it in circumstances, like if you're in a state of fear or overwhelm or rage or whatever emotional state you're in, you can access unified consciousness, calm yourself down, take a breath, and then, speak with your highest self. That's what I'm working on. That's a practice. It's a lifelong practice, but that's kind of some of the ideas.
Yeah. Well, I liked it at the beginning of the book that you noted that, you have to work on yourself every day. And I think that is so true because none of us are ever finished products.
Definitely not. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So the first half of the book is really about, that inner work, self-liberation, the journey of liberation. We're all on a journey of fulfillment and awakening. And so it gives some, kind of ideas and practices for figuring that out and experimenting and, evolving yourself as you evolve and as the world evolves so that it's not a static thing. It's an ongoing kind of thing. And then step four is really peace crafting, which is about how you relate to other people.
Yeah. Well, I do want to go into the peace crafting, but I want to stay here for a
Okay.
moment with
Yeah.
this inner work because one of the things that came to mind when reading this, you mentioned liberation theology. And there's also the Jewish traditions of Tikkun HaNefesh and Tikkun HaOlam, which I'm familiar with the second one, which is you know that it's the healing of the soul is inextricably linked to our efforts to heal the world. And what I was thinking of was more along the lines of the liberation theology, in particular, Leonardo Boff in his book, Cry of the Earth, Cry of the Poor. And at the end of that, he mentions that what we need is an inner ecology. And that's what I kept kind of going back to as I was reading that first part of the book, was that's kind of what you're suggesting is an inner ecology, because you're recognizing that what's going on outside is a reflection of what's going on inside.
Exactly. Yes. That's the beauty and the challenge of it. Because we are mammals living, and we have minds and emotions, and we have nervous systems. And yeah, we all have what I call in the book an inner dragon, an inner critic. It's part of our psychology, it's part of our nervous system. It keeps us safe. You know, it's like our fight or flight response in the kind of an emergency. And then the experiences that we have in life, everyone has some form of trauma. Some people have more or less kind of versions of it, but everyone is managing some form of the inner dragon, you know? And that's that voice that tells you you're not good enough and da 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 da, or you're stupid, or be quiet, or no one wants to hear from you, or all this. I call it the, speaking of liberation theology, I call it the Pharaoh film factory. It's like, you know, the oppressor, you know, puts films up on my in my mind, and they play, and I create this kind of reality. It's a narrative reality that I'm a victim and that I'm being oppressed. And that is exactly the point that you made, in my view. It's that the systems externally that we're living under are systems of oppression. They're designed that way. For example, the US Constitution, which all Americans are living under for the last 237 years, is a caste system. It's a system of oppression. It's about controlling economically, politically, socially, a group of wealthy slave owners oppressing all others so that they could retain their power. So, you know, that our willingness to live under that kind of system is because that system is inside of us. So we have to like heal ourselves from that, and see that we don't have to limit ourselves to that limitation, and we can co-create a new way of doing things. All they did back there was put words on a piece of paper. They were just humans living at that time that had an enlightenment of whatever, and they articulated that. And that's what I believe we need to do that again now, not here alone, but globally. This system that I'm talking about, racism and extractive capitalism that are driving the climate emergency. We are doing progress on the climate emergency, but we're not winning. We're still losing. So we need a new economic system called regenerative economics, you know. So we can't do that under extractive capitalism, because it's not, it's like, you know, the two things don't connect. I don't know. Maybe that was too much, but I was
No.
disappointed. Yes, what you're saying is exactly the thesis of the book, healing ourselves, our soul, you know, unleashing our full power. As is part of and our full imagination. Like, I really want to unlock political imagination, radical imagination. What kind of world do we want to create? It's not up to me. I don't have all the answers. We have to co-create it.
Yeah, no, I think that everything you said was perfect. And that's something that I had written down here. So I have quotes from the book. And my little note on the side was that we need to decolonize our minds.
Exactly. Yes. And that is why in step seven, I talk about caste, you know, that Isabel Wilkerson wrote this book about caste. And I really got something very deep during that writing of that, which, and she says, caste is healable. And I was like, yes, thank you. Yes, now we're the ones that get to heal it. And caste lives within inside of me for sure. You know, I'm a survivor of early childhood sexual violence at the hands of my father. And it was sexual violence. It was oppression. He was an angry man. He threw dishes. He punched holes in the wall. He was, you know, he oppressed those around him. So since I was a young boy, I was, you know, kind of quietly watching oppression. And that's why I became an advocate and I'm for liberation and freedom and people living into their full potential. And so I feel like the good news is that we can heal these caste systems that occur within us and collectively, and it's hard work. I don't want to make this sound easy. And we need to do it together. We're not alone. We're in this together. We have to support each other as friends, as neighbors, you know? We have to be peaceful and loving. We
Yeah,
can do it. Most people want to do it.
I think that a lot of people just they don't know where to start. And something that I hear often, and I'm going to say I'm a little bit guilty of this as well, is that we're all hustling. We're all so busy, and it's like, and you want me to save the world.
No, I want you to realize you already are and receive the praise of that and understand that you are complete, and you are contributing. And every love-centered action counts and matters. And what I am like, I need guidance from you and your listeners on is like, a lot of people I talk to are like, oh, I'm doing this, this, and this. Oh, but I don't feel like I'm doing anything. How you're saving the world. I'm like, I'm not saving the world. I wrote a book. I'm sharing ideas. It's not saving the world. It's like, it's got to be a we, And people are always self-diminishing, self-criticizing. And I'm like, do you realize what you're doing? That's it. So that's part of the inner dragon. It sends that tape. I'm not enough, or I feel shame for this or that, So the practices in the book are designed to, just navigate that and experiment with creating new neural pathways, actually, that are revolutionary optimistic.
And I really appreciated the inner spiritual aspect to this. My background's in religious studies, and one of the things that I know is that almost every single religion, the world religion, at its core is addressing systems of oppression.
Yeah, exactly. And they're all set. I've studied Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism, Native, Indigenous, humanistic, all these different. I've practiced many of them, and I was born a Jew, and I practiced Judaism as well. But the truth is, I'm inner spiritual because I can walk into a prayer service anywhere and get filled because I know it's I decode it. And I just say, oh, this is about what this is the beauty of the diversity. And actually, these are the different ways that the path of love is manifesting. It's not, it's I love that. I love investigating that and learning from all that. It's so fun.
Well, it's about finding commonalities rather than focusing on the differences, right?
Exactly.
And
And those are narratives in my head. I had a, and I talk about this in the book, like, we have the Hollywood films, or I was raised to be afraid of certain kind of people, and I realized that those are narratives that aren't real. I don't have to live that way. I don't have to live with a fear-based narrative.
We need to change the stories that we tell. Because those,
Ourselves.
well, it's inner and outer. It's,
In or out, yeah,
because
exactly.
we are not separate from anything else. And you mentioned, and this was a concept that I learned probably over a decade ago, and I think it comes from Archbishop Tutu, Desmond Tutu, of Ubuntu, Ubuntu. And the way I learned it was, I am because you are, or we are, that it is that you can't separate the individual from the group,
Exactly.
and it just seems like the narrative, the dominant narrative that we have running through our minds is because we're constantly told we are separate and we have to focus just on ourselves and not the community, but that's not a true story.
Yeah, that's the inner dragon in my view, trying to protect us from, all these like things that are seen as scary or fearful or that are triggering. So we have to learn how to manage our own triggers, which is in step two, and we have to take 100% radical self-responsibility for managing our own triggers. That's an internal journey, But yeah, I think Ubuntu consciousness is what I said. As a revolutionary optimist, we have to, but I forget that sometimes. I get triggered or I'm like upset about what's going on, and I forget that we're all interconnected. And so, it's a daily reminder of that. It's a daily practice to, remind my, and doing it in community and spiritual community, I think is a really important way to get a taste, another taste of it, so that I can bring that into my week ahead, you know? So I do think it's a regular practice.
Yeah. Well, it seems that what is so important with this as well is that, focusing on the spirituality aspect of it, is that there has to be a communal aspect. And one of my criticisms of, growing up in the 70s and 80s, you would hear all the time, if you want to change the world, change yourself. And there is truth to that. But often what would happen was this sort of narcissistic focus, and people just didn't, it was just about the individual spirituality. And we've got this changing now in the United States, at least, that the fastest growing demographic are people who identify as spiritual but not religious. And it seems to me that one of the tasks here is to be able to develop communities within this new spiritual landscape.
Thank you. That's a great perspective, and it's very inspiring, actually, that perhaps that's a tipping point, of awareness where this can happen now. Because if people are staying in their lane or their box, then you're not willing to, transcend it, then that has been part of the challenge, that we have been facing. Look at the wars happening all over the world, and a lot of them have a religious like foundation to it. So people feel betrayed by how religion has been used by for power and for control and oppression. As you said, we're back on the oppression tip. That's not the intent of the religious spiritual leaders. They weren't, as far as I know, and any of them that I've experienced or studied, none of them were like, please use these ideas to oppress other people. No, but we've seen that over and over again. And we're seeing that now in the world today, even with the state of Israel. The way that they're interacting with the Palestinian people and a, horrible, outrageous, unacceptable, illegal behavior according to the international law that we currently have on the planet. So, it's up to us to create awareness and to step into a more authentic, like you said, interspirituality that is really the love-centered, really the path of love. Now, people say, oh, you sound like spiritual. We can't do that in politics. I'm like, no, we need to put love at the center. We have greed and oppression and destruction happening with the current social, economic, and political systems. The only thing that can get to transform that is love, So putting love at the center of our social, economic, and political systems. I'm being told by people not to say that word. I'm like, I am saying that word. And you know why? Martin Luther King lived by the politics of love. And I am a student of his, and he's a mentor of mine. And not only him, but the whole movement that he led and he was part of. There were many leaders. It was a leaderful movement, Shuttlesworth and all these other leaders. And that's what's happening now, too. We have a revolutionary movement sort of brewing all over the country and the world. And amazing leaders everywhere. I'm so excited with what I'm seeing and what you just said. How do we tap into that is what I don't know. Maybe your podcast, or I'm not sure how to, bring those folks into like an awareness of this could be a revolutionary phase. We have evolutionary progress, and what's the role of the spiritual communities and spiritual awareness during a revolutionary phase? Like, please support it. I don't know how. But like any way folks choose to engage is welcomed, I think.
For sure. And I think that, with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., I really appreciate what you were just saying, because I think often there's this tendency to think that, Dr. King was the civil rights movement. And it's like, no, he was only able to do that because there were all these other leaders and people that were willing to put their spirituality into action and their love into
Exactly.
action.
Yeah, exactly. And you might have given me a clue here. I'm just like realizing it because I've actually been literally thinking and talking with faith leaders. I'm like, you know what? Every meeting was organized at the church, the mass meetings, and it was very spiritually driven. The songs, the freedom songs, were spiritually originating, from liberation theology and Jesus and all of those teachings. They were driving this movement, and I'm like, where is that today? It's not there. The people who are most invigorated are young people, and now we're seeing an interspiritual Palestinian liberation movement, and that's kind of got the right energy, for the transformation that we need. But women aren't out there. I don't feel the women's movement, or men and women, calling for freedom of how we care for our own bodies,
Right. Yeah. Well, and that was something I thought about in terms of, one of the things you were writing about was like protests. And I remember participating in the, the women's marches, but I had a criticism. It's like, but now what? It's like just showing up and marching isn't going to do anything. It may make you feel better, but ultimately there has to be something else. Protests are a tool. It's not the only way.
Yeah, no, well said. And in revolutionary optimism, step six is called Imagineering, and we talk about what do you want to take a stand for as part of what you care about, and then how do you build movements? And there are best practices, and there are good things to do to have successful movements. And then step six is sparking peaceful revolutions, and that's about direct action and non-cooperation. And I think that's where we're at. And non-cooperation can mean you're sitting at home and you're not doing something that is contributing to a collective action against an oppressive system. So it doesn't necessarily mean you're out on the streets getting arrested, although that does, I think, need to be part of it. Peaceful, nonviolent mobilizations need to be scaled up. I was just in Alabama recently and I did a deep dive into the civil rights movement. And one of the things that I learned was that it took time to build up the momentum with small actions. The velocity of actions, the frequency of actions is directly correlated with the change of policy. So the more frequent actions, and then at a certain point to get the big macro national changes, like we saw in, Selma with the Voting Rights Act and like Birmingham with the bus boycott, which led to the civil rights law. These things happened when the whole population literally mobilized, the oppressed population mobilized, and allies. So it doesn't happen overnight. It takes time to build readiness.
And I think that the challenge, especially with what I was saying about this new demographic of, spiritual but not religious, is the civil rights, like you had noted, that was all grounded in the churches, and the churches could, connect and everything. But if you've got no churches, how do you connect people?
So we're inviting people. That's a big part of this book launch for me, which is that we don't know yet because it's not out. But my sense is that this is a great opportunity to, read the book with friends, with neighbors, deepen relationships, and share your experience with the practices. Do the practices yourself if you want, or do them as a group. And we're putting out a journal and workbook with guiding questions for groups. And those can be however you want to group yourself. There are still some people that go to church or synagogue or mosques, so they could do it there, or neighbor groups or family groups or rebel spirit groups. We don't care what you call them, revolutionary optimism groups, unified groups, whatever. But yeah, bringing people together to have deepen those relationships, which people have been saying to me has been lost in our modern culture. We're all in our little phones, and COVID also made us more isolated, and that's and all this anxiety and fear. So many people are feeling a sense of isolation, and so I'm hoping that revolutionary optimism is a way to have fun together. It's you can do it over time. It's always evergreen, right? Like every step you have to keep doing over and over. I do. And I will be walking around with the book and using it because I'm using it now. And that's why I'm so optimistic in the face of what seems to be a bad moment.
Well, I often ask guests, especially in regards to the climate crisis, the guests that I've had on that we've discussed this, whether or not they have hope. But that's not a question for you because you've got hope.
Most of this, only when I'm a revolutionary optimist,
I
when I
see.
like lose it and I like real, I go into, I have gone into this deep despair about the state of the situation. Yeah, it's not good. It's dire. Yeah.
It is. It is. And sometimes I wonder if people truly understand how dire it is. And it seems like there has to be this balance between recognizing sort of the reality of the situations that we're facing. And, you had mentioned earlier about, the grief and the anxiety and everything that we feel, that we need to be able to honor that, but not allow us to enter into hopelessness.
Exactly. And I think that's where a lot of people are. At least that's where I had been, as I really understood what was going on. And we know young people and all people are getting like information at a greater velocity in this era, and they really know what's going on. Even young kids, they're aware of the situation, and they don't know these words yet. They don't know that they're being betrayed by their government
Right.
and by the political leadership. And many people don't want to say that. Everyone's like, oh, everything's great. These folks are doing a great job. And I'm like, are you kidding me? I
Yeah.
have a granddaughter and a grandson, and they're going to be 80 and 2100, and I cannot guarantee them that the planet will be habitable by then.
Right.
We're in a bed. We may not have human capacity to live on this planet by then. So this is happening over the next couple of decades, and what we do now really matters. So I believe that we also need, like, everything that's happening is under this system of oppression, extractive capitalism. It's about greed, take whatever you can and make sure you have all the power. And so we need a whole, we have, you can't fix the climate emergency under that system, in my view. You have to have a closed loop, circular, regenerative economy. This is already happening in countries and corporations and communities around the world. We just need to have macro frameworks that support that transformation. It's already happening at the local level. That's the good news. So I'm very optimistic about that. And then the policy framework at the global level is archaic and failing. The focus of John Kerry and John Podesta and Joe Biden and all these folks is re CO2 reduction only. And that is not working. CO2 emissions are still going up. The climate temperature is still going up. So the mantra for 50 years that we've been under is reduce CO2 emissions. It's not working. So we need to do that, and we need to do restoration and repair. We need to do regeneration economics, as I said, and we need to prepare for consequences of our inaction and do direct climate cooling. We have to do research on anything that we can to cool the planet to keep the life viable. So the whole leadership of our country and our government, the global response, the UN FCCC, whatever it is completely broken, as evidenced by the data that they publish.
Well, it seems to me
We can do
that,
better. My view
oh,
is we can do better. Yeah,
yeah.
we have to.
Yeah. Well, it seems that
Does that
something,
resonate?
pardon?
Does that resonate?
Oh yeah, I mean the what I was trying to get at is that because I've been in higher education for 30 years now and I've been teaching for the past 20 years. And I think that that is a key component with all of this is education. There are times I go in with my classes and I've been at the community college level. I just want to apologize to my students. Like, I am so sorry that this is what you've inherited. And I get very frustrated because the colleges are all focused on, student success. And I'm coming from a place where I'm like, yes, but your definition of student success is training them for these ecocidal jobs. That's, but a true education needs to open up the imagination and to address these problems.
Well
And
said. Yeah, well said. I couldn't agree more. Anything I can do to support your efforts to try can move in that direction, that's you're right. It is education. It's central. So how can it evolve in this time that we're in? Some institutions have innovation hubs and there's some great stuff happening in many institutions, but in many they're not, and many are going backwards. So, we have all these opportunities to pursue.
Yeah, we do. And I think that's a good way of looking at it is that there are opportunities here. But yeah.
Yeah, I mean, And we just have to say enough is enough, and we're angry and we're not going to put up with it. We have to
Yeah.
really just say, folks, we need a new way. And this is inherited from the past and it's not working for our well-being and our future survival. And, bring our love energy and our fierce urgency of now energy.
Yeah.
In his speech where he talked about the fierce urgency now, it's in the book, the quote, that he was like sharing the story of civilizations that have come and gone. And he led and he introduced this idea of trying to bring fierce urgency of now, because what's happened is that they end up not surviving, and they were lost in the epitaph, he says, of too late.
Yeah.
So we're right at the point where we're almost too late. But if we, I believe strongly, and that I think there's evidence that if we do a revolutionary, peaceful, revolutionary, nonviolent transformation relatively fast over 18 months to 2 years, then we can actually get everything on track and do things a new and different way. I don't know when those 2 years are going to be. It feels
Yeah.
like it could be now. Like it could be that tipping point that you were talking about before. Like there is everyone ready for all this stuff. We seem like we're ready to go. I don't know if it's like 1.6 billion people or 3.2 billion people or 7.5 billion people that are ready that we go. I don't know. I just know it feels like it's happening.
Yeah, I hope so. And I think it's also really important to consider, what you were talking about, your grandchildren. The way I think about it is we are the ancestors,
Yes.
and our actions now, I think in some of the Native American traditions, it's, you think 7 generations out. And
Right.
I think we need to
Right.
kind of
Well
start
said.
doing a lot of that. And I think that it would be helpful too to have interreligious dialogues. We need to have, the Baptist talking with the Muslims, talking with the Catholics, talking with, the Orthodox Jews, talking with the neo-pagans. We need to start having these group conversations somehow and
Yeah.
focusing on the similarities and not the differences that unify consciousness.
Exactly. Yeah, I did. I've done several interspiritual gathering retreats, like week-long retreats, and I highly recommend those kind of spaces where it's safe space and you get to ask questions and you get to say the stupid ideas that you were imprinted with, and you demyth you get rid of myths that that kept me apart from people, honestly. So there's a lot to learn and grow. And again, it's can be so fulfilling when we know that we're all, we're all linked by that quest for love and for our collective liberation. I mean, I think those are universal intentions of all souls in a way.
Yeah. Well, I know that we're starting to run out of time here, but I wanted to ask you a question going back to this idea of the inner dragon. And often we think about slaying the dragons, but I'm wondering, is that the appropriate approach? Are we supposed to slay the dragon, or would it be better to try to make the dragon our ally somehow?
Great question. Yeah. So in the book Revolutionary Optimism, I talk about another book, which I highly recommend, called Whole Brain Living. And this is written by a neuroanatomist, and she had a stroke and lost some of the functioning in her brain. And then over time, the functioning came back. And what she was able to discern from that experience, her expertise, and then this life experience, she defines whole brain living, which basically says that there are neural bundles and in different parts of our physical brain that manifest as different characters. And there's four characters. And the inner dragon is really a combination of, left brain characters. So left brain is the side of the brain that drives, our ego and our protection systems, and our inner child is all over there. And then our right brain is the creative, playful, joyful side and the spiritual higher side. And so what she teaches in her book is to say, I have four characters, operating in my brain, and a couple of them work conspire together to be my inner dragon. Or they trade off, they're in it together though, and they dominated me. So all it is, it becomes like, okay, I'm going to choose to let my right brain, rule the roost and make the, I need their perspectives. I need their experience. I need the lessons learned, the things that worked for them, the things that failed for them, all that life experience that I've had with them. And you do a peace huddle. You huddle the four parts of yourself and you have a peace huddle. I call it a peace huddle. He calls it a huddle. But I have a peace summit with them. When my inner dragon gets too wild, I'm like, okay, fellas, let's have a peace summit. Let's sit around and I have to center myself and I have to say, no, I am a man of peace. I'm a man of love. I like to have fun. I'm feeling, whatever I'm feeling. You know what I mean? So I do think it's about understanding how your mind operates and then. Yeah, it's a whack-a-mole. I did try. It's like decades, and I tried all these techniques to slay it. It doesn't work. It's like a whack-a-mole. It keeps coming back. So you have to recognize that it's there and bring it into like a solidarity. Value it. It had a value. Like it helped me be who I am.
One of the things I was thinking of when asking the question is I have a general anxiety disorder, and it's been in the past, it's been a problem until I recognized one day, I'm like, I need to stop looking at this as something I need to get over, but to recognize it as my ally because the anxiety serves a purpose. I mean, through evolution, anxiety serves a purpose. And it seems to me that a lot of the qualities of that inner dragon serve a beneficial purpose. It's just been kind of inflated beyond what it ought to be. And so
Exactly right.
we just need to figure out how to tap into those powers for the good, for the common good.
Right, exactly. Well said. Yeah. So thank you for sharing that and for your vulnerability about that. And you're not alone, right? A lot of people have some form of anxiety. And it's about what you said. Yeah. It's about honoring that part of ourselves, right? It's part of our survival. And we don't have to live with our inner dragon making all of our decisions and controlling our lives. And we know that they haven't always, right? We've had fun at some point. We laugh occasionally, or we do we are spiritual, or we're connected to a broader power or interconnectedness, as you said. So those are things where so then it's just saying, oh, I want to live over there. I want to live in that. I want to be dominant there. That's what I'm working on. I'm not there, but I mean that's where I'm tacking. I'm taking the ship that way. I'm sailing in that direction. But it's a lifelong journey, as you said.
Well, that takes us back to the beginning with the idea of the inner work, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because
Absolutely.
I was going to ask, since we're pretty much at the end now, anyone who's listening or watching to this, let's say they're like, yeah, I want to do something now. This makes sense to me. Is that the place you would recommend that they start? Is just start by doing a examination of your life, your values, or something in conjunction with that, find the others perhaps. What would you recommend?
Yeah, so at revolutionaryoptimism.com, we have the book, the workbook, a Changemaker's Companion Kit, it's called, with, and we're going to be there to do this together to support people as they go through this. If they do form groups and they want to go through revolutionary optimism together, look, this is only one of many ways for self-liberation and self-healing. So I honor every other path. I'm offering this as a love offering for those who want to pursue something that is based on the moment that we're in. This is really designed for this particular moment, May 1st, 2024, like the situation that we're in the world right now. So, and it's like I wished I had a book like this when I was 15, 20, 30, 40, even in my 50s. I would have found a lot of value in a synthesis that just said, try this with friends and have fun, So like I'm offering it because I wished I had had it,
Well, it's a good guide, and I am grateful that you wrote it. I'm always grateful for people who are doing all the good hard work, because it needs to be done. Definitely needs to be done. So, unfortunately, I know that we're out of time, but the website is revolutionaryoptimism.com. And the book's going to be available on, I imagine, Amazon and bookstores and whatnot. I'll put the link to the website and to the book in the show notes in the video description so we can get that out. And I'll just say, Paul, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. I do wish we had a little bit more time, but this has been a great conversation.
Well, thank you, Nick, for your insights and for helping me like think about this. I really learned a few tidbits here, and maybe, I'm happy to come back at some time if you want to dig in further and see how it's evolving, Like I forgot to tell you, revolutionary optimism is contagious, and there's no known cure or vaccine. So once it's spreading, it moves fast.
Well, that's good to know. That's good to know. So we'll definitely have to speak again because I think this is the great work. This is the important work that needs to be done right now.
Yeah, well, thank you for your words, and I appreciate you. Have a great week.
Okay, thanks. You too. And that's a wrap on episode 136 of Rebel Spirit Radio. Thank you so much for listening or watching if you're a part of my YouTube audience. Now, you know what's coming next. All the usual. Sign up for my Patreon, share this with friends and family and on social media, and subscribe to the podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. You know the grind. But here's the thing, all of that is really important. Right now, putting this podcast together is a labor of love. I'm in the process of making changes to improve the podcast and the YouTube channel. It's slow going, but your support will help me speed up the process and ensure that I can continue with the podcast and offer much more content than what I provide now. As I always like to say, I'm here in the front range doing missionary work in regards to religion, spirituality, and ecology, psychedelics and consciousness, and how all of this can help us heal humanity's relationship with the sacred earth. So if you feel moved by the rebel spirit, and I sure hope that you do, then please, by all means, help me in my efforts to share the good news. I'm Nick Mather, and you've been listening to or watching Rebel Spirit Radio. Until next time, may you be in peace, may you flourish in all possible ways, and may you continue to nurture your rebel spirit.